Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. I'm Scott Harris. This week we present Helen Benedict, professor of journalism at Columbia University, who talks about the police suppression of free speech on college campuses and the charge that pro-Palestinian anti-war students are being manipulated by outside agitators. Ryan Grimm, The Intercept's DC bureau chief, who examines a recent survey which reveals how biased cable news coverage of Israel's Gaza war skews American public opinion. And Kiko Matos of the National Immigration Law Center, who talks about the Biden administration's expansion of the Affordable Care Act to allow participants in DACA to enroll in the health insurance program. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Weeks of torrential rains in East Africa have triggered floods which have caused the deaths of over 200 people in Kenya, Tanzania, and Burundi. Landslides destroyed homes and businesses in poor urban neighborhoods already hard hit by the climate crisis and failing infrastructure. The deadly rain revealed how poor people who live in sprawling shantytowns without access to proper roads, water, or power bear the biggest brunt of destructive floods. The New York Times reported that activists and opposition figures across the region are calling on governments to improve infrastructure to prevent future flooding. In Tanzania, the heavy rains affected some 200,000 people, with farms, bridges, roads, schools, places of worship, and 10,000 homes suffering damage. The latest downpours come just months after torrential rains and floods killed and displaced thousands more across East Africa. Climate scientists say those rains, along with earlier devastating droughts, were exacerbated by climate change. The United Auto Workers is expanding its organizing reach. After the union won historic new contracts with the big three automakers, they've broken new ground by successfully organizing a Volkswagen auto plant in Tennessee, the first union victory at an auto plant in the American South in decades. Now, the UAW is investing in organizers to work with independent auto unions in Mexico to fight decades of declining wages and confront corrupt union leaders who resist rank-and-file challenges. Since the North American Free Trade Agreement was signed 30 years ago, the Mexican auto workforce grew eightfold, but average auto workers' wages have fallen by half. Big auto companies reaped big profits by exploiting cheap labor. The UAW's Region 9A director, Brandon Mancilla, told In These Times, "Rather than thinking of Mexican workers as our adversaries, we need to see each other as partners in the struggle for worker power. No worker benefits from the international race to the bottom that the companies like to call global competition." The world's second largest meat packer, Tyson Foods, dumped millions of pounds of toxic pollutants from its meat and poultry plants into American rivers and lakes over the last 5 years. According to the Union of Concerned Scientists, which calculated the scope of the dumping, the contaminants in 87 billion gallons of wastewater threatened vital ecosystems, endangering wildlife and human health. The Guardian reports that nitrogen, phosphorus, chlorine, and cyanide were found in 371 million pounds of pollutants from 41 Tyson slaughterhouses and meat processing plants between 2018 and 2022. Half the wastewater was released directly into streams, rivers, lakes, and wetlands in Nebraska, Illinois, and Missouri, which local communities rely on for drinking water, fishing, and recreation. The vast majority of meat processing plants in the U.S. are exempt from existing water regulations. A 2017 lawsuit by environmental groups forced the EPA to update its two-decade-old pollution standards for slaughterhouses and animal rendering facilities. Although new rules are expected by September 2025, the agency said that it's leaning toward the weakest option, which critics warn will enable huge amounts of pollutants to keep pouring into America's waterways. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Anna Manzo.
One day after Hamas accepted a Gaza ceasefire agreement proposed by Qatari and Egyptian mediators, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu rejected the deal, declaring an end to the war as unacceptable, and launched the long-feared military offensive in the city of Rafah. Before the May 7th offensive got underway, President Biden reiterated his opposition to an Israeli Rafah ground invasion, where more than 1 million displaced Palestinian civilians have sought refuge from the seven-month-long war. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres warned Israel that a full-scale assault in Rafah would be a strategic mistake, a political calamity, and a humanitarian nightmare. Students at colleges and universities across the U.S. continue to protest Israel's war in Gaza that has now killed more than 34,000 Palestinians, most of them women and children. As Republican and Democratic politicians vilify student anti-war activists as anti-Semitic and pro-terrorists, university administrators have called in police to clear Gaza peace encampments, arresting more than 2,400 people on at least 51 campuses. Your reporter spoke with Helen Benedict, an award-winning author and professor of journalism at Columbia University, which has been the epicenter of the pro-Palestinian U.S. student movement. Here she talks about the police suppression of free speech on campus and the charge that student activists are being manipulated by outside agitators to take a stand against U.S. complicity in the slaughter of tens of thousands of Palestinian civilians in Gaza.
This phrase, outside agitators, tends to mean that there are outsiders who come with ill intent to whip up hapless students and turn them violent. Nothing like that has happened at all. For one thing, even the New York Times that did an investigation, as well as my own student journalist did one, found that of all the people who were arrested last time, actually only 9 were outsiders. Most of the others were all affiliated with Columbia graduate students. And the outsiders were either people standing around just to support outside the gates who got swept up, or advisors, people who were practiced at helping run demonstrations and protests in a peaceful, orderly manner, who these students had invited in to help them deal with things like keeping themselves safe from the real outsiders, these antagonists who might come and threaten them, some of whom have been congregating on Broadway outside of the campus for a long time now, and the press has muddled those up with our students. And some of them are really extremists on both sides and have shouted hateful things and have been very threatening to the students inside, who have been incredibly peaceful, incredibly together. Involve a lot of Jewish students who had a Seder in the encampment and have been anything but violent. So having one of the ones that got Mayor Adams all upset was a grandmother who'd been advising people on keeping safe and peaceful and reasonable with each other during these very fraught times for a long time. So, yes, it's a complete misnomer and a myth about this outside agitator business. And most of all, I must say, it puts down the students because it takes away their autonomy and their purpose. They know what they're doing, and they're very focused on peace in Gaza and Palestine. That's what they want, and bringing back the hostages safe. And they're not going to be pushed around by outsiders either. It takes away their dignity to say such a thing.
Professor Benedict, I wanted to ask you about something that you wrote about in a recent article, that there's concern that the current protests and the media coverage of these protests is unfortunately distracting important attention from the horrible carnage in Gaza, where more than 34,000 Palestinians, mostly women and children, have been killed in 7 months of the Israeli air and ground assault. And, of course, all this is going on in one of the most densely populated areas in the world, where it appears that starvation is being used as a weapon by Israel in blocking just basic humanitarian aid from coming into the territory. And I'll just mention that this was mentioned in an article that you wrote titled "The Distortion of Campus Protests Over Gaza."
The students have not forgotten that this is all about what's happening to Palestinians and what's happening in Gaza. Maybe you know, the storyline right now is all about protests and police on campus and freedom of speech and academic freedom, which are important issues. But the real issue, the reason they're out there risking their lives and limbs in many ways, or I don't mean literal lives, but I mean their futures, is because they want an end to this war. So I do think that we've gotten distracted. And of course, it's partly because it's right here under our nose. But and I don't want to sound as if I'm a conspiracy theorist here, because I'm not. But of course, if the right had had in their mind a way to distract us all from what's happening in Gaza, screaming about anti-Semitism and saying it where I'm Jewish, by the way, so I don't mean that I don't take anti-Semitism extremely seriously, and I've experienced it myself. But creating this false narrative, so we talk about that instead of Gaza, and then we talk about the student protests and so on instead of Gaza. If that's what they wanted, they've been succeeding.
That was Helen Benedict, an author and professor of journalism at Columbia University. Her latest novel is titled The Good Deed. Find a link to her recent article, The Distortion of Campus Protests Over Gaza, and related commentary by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. With hope fading that a ceasefire agreement between Israel and Hamas can be salvaged to release hostages and deliver desperately needed humanitarian aid into Gaza, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's government launched his long-promised offensive in the city of Rafah on May 7th. Gaza's southernmost city is crowded with over 1 million desperate Palestinian refugees who fled there seeking safety from indiscriminate Israeli bomb and missile attacks. As Israeli tanks seize control of the Palestinian side of the Rafah crossing, aid agency officials in the territory said the flow of humanitarian assistance through Rafah had been entirely halted. There are 2.3 million Gaza residents who face starvation, with severe shortages of potable water, basic sanitation, and little or no access to health care. The United Nations World Food Program says northern Gaza has now entered a stage of full-blown famine. Depending on their news sources, U.S. news consumers may or may not fully grasp the desperate reality of Palestinians who must fight every day to survive Israel's seven-month-long war that has thus far killed more than 34,000, mostly women and children. Your reporter spoke with Ryan Grimm, The Intercept's D.C. bureau chief, who examines a recent survey which reveals how biased cable news coverage of Israel's Gaza war skews American public opinion.
You don't often see divergences that stark, but if somebody said that they primarily got their news from cable, they were the kind of least likely group to say that Israel was committing a genocide in Gaza. In fact, they were the only group, the only subset of Americans that did not believe, by at least a plurality, that Israel is committing a genocide in Gaza. Now, even they, about a third of them, did believe that that was the case. that Israel is committing a genocide in Gaza, but everyone else, whether you, if you got your news from print media, social media, or YouTube, believed that Israel was committing a genocide. And there was also some kind of interesting divergence where even on, say, cable, you had a significant number of people who said that, yes, Israel is committing genocide in Gaza. We're still sympathizing with the Israeli side of it, which is a pretty kind of disturbing set of answers if you unpack those.
Ryan, anecdotally, what kinds of things are you seeing on cable that would have people coming to those conclusions and the opposite of what people who are using social media, for example, to get their unfiltered news about what's going on in Gaza and what Israel is doing to prosecute this war? What are some of the things that you see that may be distorting the images of how people perceive the war in Gaza?
I mean, and part of it, it's a state maybe the obvious, is a bit of a chicken and egg problem. It is a fact that, young people are more likely to get their news from Instagram and TikTok. Older people are more likely to get their news from cable, and independent, really, of where they get their news, old people are more likely to be conservative in this generation, and young people are more likely to be progressive. So, that's going to tilt the scales a little bit, but nowhere near the extent that we saw. And to answer your question, it really is what Anthony Blinken talked about openly over the weekend. People who get their news from social media, particularly Instagram, Twitter, and TikTok, are seeing videos of the destruction. They are seeing what is being done to people in Gaza. They are developing connections to those people. They're building the same kinds of parasocial relationships that people form with any Instagram or TikTok influencer, but with people that they're regularly checking in on in Gaza. And then they're worrying about those people. And in some cases, they're seeing those people getting ripped apart. And that, as Anthony Blinken said over the weekend and in this really, really honest interview, shockingly honest interview with Mitt Romney on a stage at a conference, he said that was causing a major problem for Israel's narrative of the war, that people were able to get this direct look. And Mitt Romney responded by saying, yes, in fact, that's one of the reasons why, we in Congress moved forward with this effort to ban TikTok. And you would think that you might even say after you've said that the carnage is the problem. But to believe, that it's people's ability to see the carnage that is the actual problem, was extraordinarily revealing. Mike Lawler is a Republican, moderate Republican in upstate New York, and the lead co-sponsor of the legislation, also said on a call with the organization No Labels, I assume you've covered them before, this kind of quasi-centrist but really just pro-corporate organization that tried to get Joe Manchin to run for president and some other shenanigans. He was at a No Labels event it was a private event, but we got audio of it. And he said in that event, too, the exact same thing, that the kids are being manipulated, was how he put it, by these algorithms. And that's why Congress had to move ahead and block them. On cable, you're not going to see that. And you're going to see, a dramatically mediated understanding of the situation there. And in fact, on cable, you're often going to see kind of rehashing of October 7th atrocities. And you're going to see the regular interviews, constant interviews with Israeli or IDF spokespeople. And so if you're not watching cable, then you're not getting as much of that. It was probably even more pronounced. We conducted this before the kind of crackdowns on the campus protests, but I bet the results would be much more, even more pronounced with the coverage of those, because the coverage of, if you're only watching cable, you think that there are, anti-Semitic mobs a la Charlottesville rampaging all over every campus and around the world. If you're watching TikTok and Instagram and Twitter and you're seeing the actual demonstrators and hearing directly from them, then you're seeing that these are peace activists who are camping out to try to get their universities to divest from the war effort in Israel.
That was Ryan Grimm, The Intercept's D.C. bureau chief. Find a link to his recent article titled, "Cable News Viewers Have a Skewed Attitude Toward Gaza War," survey finds, and related analysis and commentary by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. On May 3rd, the Biden administration announced an expansion of the nation's health care program, the Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare. President Biden's exercise of his executive power will permit hundreds of thousands of participants in the DACA program, Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, to enroll in the ACA. Almost one-third of the 580,000 DACA recipients don't have access to insurance, and until now, were ineligible for federal health programs. Recipients of DACA are about three times more likely than the general public to be uninsured. DACA recipients who are eligible for the ACA can apply for and receive coverage as early as November 1st this year. President Obama initiated the DACA program in 2012 to allow the so-called Dreamers, immigrants who came to the U.S. as children, to legally work, go to school, or serve in the military. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Kika Matos, president of the National Immigration Law Center, or NILC. Here she talks about how this change in the ACA came about and what it will mean for the nation's dreamers.
This has been a significant priority for NILC and for other organizations that have advocated on behalf of DACA recipients. Recall that executive order that protected young people that are typically known as dreamers from deportation and that allowed them to have work permits. That executive order was issued in 2012. And at the time that the executive order was issued, DACA recipients were unfairly excluded from the definition of lawfully present. And so they have had no access to the Affordable Care Act or Medicaid or any type of health insurance. During the time that the Affordable Care Act was being rolled out, NILC, United We Dream, and a handful of other organizations were urging the federal government not to exclude DACA recipients, but they went ahead and excluded them. And so this order, that the final rule as of last Friday, opens the door for DACA recipients to now be able to access Obamacare.
Just remind us, this was started by President Obama, and then it certainly it's been ongoing under President Biden. But what about when Trump was president? Did he just pause the whole thing, or did that just continue apace when he was president?
No, Trump went the extra mile. He actually tried to strike down DACA altogether. A handful of organizations immediately went into litigation mode and challenged Trump's ruling, and it went all the way up to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court ruled a few years ago that it was not going to rule on the constitutionality of DACA per se, but it ruled that the way that the Trump administration tried to strike down DACA was unconstitutional. And so DACA survived that challenge. And DACA is now on a lifeline because I believe it was last year, there was ongoing litigation and a judge, an anti-immigrant judge in Texas, Andrew Hanen, ruled that DACA was unconstitutional because of the way that the rule was issued and that it was a violation of the Administrative Procedures Act. And now DACA is once again making its way up to the U.S. Supreme Court. But for now, anyone who is currently a DACA recipient can renew their status. And the Department of Homeland Security is accepting applications for people who want to apply for DACA, but it is unable to pause any new applications. So if you currently have DACA and you want to renew your status, you can do that. If you're eligible for DACA and you had never applied for DACA and you want to apply now, you can submit your application, but the Department of Homeland Security is simply unable to process it until the court rule once and for all.
Wow, it's a long legal journey.
You know, we often don't talk about the impact of long legal journeys, but this has been really painful for those who are recipients of DACA. They're mostly young people who came to the United States when they were children. On average, they've lived in the United States for 22 years. They're now in their late 20s, early 30s. Most of them, 75% of them, work. They pay billions in taxes. And they have to go through this anxiety-provoking experience where they don't know whether from one day to the next, they will be able to continue to lead meaningful lives because DACA is still on the balance and no final decision has been issued yet.
So how many people does this cover, this access to healthcare now, to coverage?
There are now on average, my understanding is that there are about 580,000 DACA recipients. So anyone at the White House estimates are such that they believe about 100,000 DACA recipients will benefit from this. And my interpretation of that is that there are 100,000 people who will likely apply for Obamacare. The remaining DACA recipients who won't apply for Obamacare likely have some kind of healthcare coverage now, likely through their employer.
Is there a next step that NILC or other immigrant rights groups are contemplating to expand health coverage even more among the undocumented population?
The next step for us is really to pivot to make sure that everybody who's eligible now for Obamacare knows what the next steps are.
That was Kika Matos, president of the National Immigration Law Center. Learn more about the changes to the ACA, making DACA recipients eligible to receive government-subsidized health care insurance, by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in streaming audio and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WRWK in Midlothian, Virginia, KTAL in Las Cruces, New Mexico, Palares Radio in Pala, California, dozens of other community radio stations across the U.S. and abroad, and wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.